Apple is under pressure to crack down on iPhone apps, apps designed for all kinds of things that, once on your phone, upload your address book without your consent. NPR's Martin Kosty has more.
This issue first bubbled up last week when a social media app called Path was revealed to be uploading address books without permission. The company quickly apologized and changed its practices, but now it seems Path was just the tip of the iceberg. Many social media apps upload address books with varying standards of disclosure and permission. Some also hold on to those contacts. Twitter now says it keeps them for up to 18 months. The situation is getting attention on Capitol Hill.
We've written to Apple about it.
Congressman Henry Waxman, the ranking Democrat on the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, says the iPhone's maker needs to take more responsibility.
Either they're not aware this sort of thing is happening, and I want to know why they weren't aware of it, or if they are aware of it, I want to know why they haven't made sure that there's a policy for any of the apps that they approve on the Apple system to make the consumers aware of what's going on and to get their permission before their privacy is invaded.
In a prepared statement, Apple said future iPhone software will require, quote, explicit user approval before apps can gain access to address books. Martin Kosty, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Nevada is getting ready to put self-driving cars on its roads. The state has finalized new rules allowing special driving permits for companies working on the new technology. From Silicon Valley, NPR's Steve Henn explains it's not quite a driver's license for robots, but it's close.
The other day, I went for a spin.
Auto driving.
In a robotic car. This car has an $80,000 cone-shaped laser mounted on its roof. There are radars on the front, back, and sides. Detailed maps help it navigate.
Have you noticed if anyone has ID'd us as a self-driving car, do you get people just pulling alongside and gawking?
We get a lot of thumbs up. You know, so people drive by and then they wave, and you know, I wish they would keep their eyes on the road.
Anthony Lewandowski is one of the leaders of Google's self-driving car project. He's in the passenger seat with a laptop showing him what the car can see. Chris Urmson is behind the wheel, but his hands are in his lap, and the steering wheel is gently turning back and forth, tracing the contours of Highway 85.
And it can adjust the speed if, you know, if there's a particularly tight corner, it'll slow down for that. It adjusts speed to stay out of blind spots of other vehicles. It tries to match speed with traffic.
The road's moving, but traffic is heavy. Chris has been working on this technology for close to a decade. His first car managed to travel just 11 miles on a dusty road. Google's vehicle is a giant leap forward.
You know, when we got this on the freeway and it was doing 70 miles an hour and just, you know, smoothly driving along the road, it was, you know, you could taste it, you know, the technology. You can see, really feel the impact and how it's going to change people's lives. Just amazing.
While he was talking, a motorcycle cuts us off. The car saw the move coming, and we hardly even noticed. Google's fleet of robotic cars has been driven more than 200,000 miles over highways and city streets in California and Nevada. Google did this testing in kind of a legal limbo. These cars aren't forbidden, but
there was no permission granted for any of that to happen by anybody.
Steve Jurvetson is a venture capitalist and a bit of a robotic car nut.
It's essential that there be a place to do tests. There's two ways to do it, the seek forgiveness strategy and the seek permission strategy. Frankly, the 200,000 hours I think that have been driven here in California, that's a seek forgiveness strategy, right?
If anything went wrong, Google would have a huge amount of explaining to do. So last year, the company hired a lobbyist in Nevada.
State of Nevada is close. It's a lot easier to pass laws there than it is in California.
Anthony Lewandowski says they convinced the state legislature to pass a law making robotic cars explicitly legal. But the legislature went further than just creating a place to test these cars. It ordered the DMV to basically create a driver's license for robot cars.
I thought it was great.
Bruce Breslow's director of the Nevada DMV.
My grandfather took me to the 1964 World's Fair in New York City many times, and they were promising me the car of the future as an 8-year-old. And I thought to myself, this finally could be it.
Starting March 1st, companies will be able to apply to test self-driving cars on Nevada's roads.
The test vehicles will be Nevada's first red license plate since the 1940s.
You can think of that like a learner's permit. These bright red plates will let everyone know there's a student robot driver behind the wheel.
And eventually, when these vehicles are sold, it'll be the first ever neon green license plate that the state of Nevada will ever issue. Green meaning go, and the future's arrived.
Google says it'll probably be years before cars like this go on sale, but Steve Jurvetson's convinced this technology could save thousands of lives.
Today, already, right now.
Robots are never distracted. They don't text or drink or get tired. They see things no human can.
That front radar catches bounces off the ground. We were driving behind an 18-wheeler, and we saw the vehicles in front of the 18-wheeler. Vehicles we could not see with our eye because the signal bounced off the pavement, right, on a glancing angle underneath the 18-wheeler. And so no human will ever have the amount of information that these cars have when they're driving.
So while Nevada may be the first state to create a licensing system for self-driving cars, it won't be the last. Hawaii, Florida, and Oklahoma are already following suit. And Jurvetson says one day, we may be asking ourselves if humans should still be allowed to drive. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Now to a fight over where to draw the line between security and privacy. This one involves cybersecurity. Some members of Congress are pushing legislation to counter a growing threat of computer espionage and attack, but they're treading carefully so they don't annoy internet watchdog groups. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the lawmakers want to avoid a repeat of a recent episode when a bill to combat online piracy blew up in their faces.
Practically everyone in Congress agrees U.S. infrastructure is vulnerable to computer attack and needs better protection. They do not agree on how to do that without harming the internet or the economy. So when Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut held a hearing Thursday on his newly unwrapped cybersecurity legislation, he spent a lot of time explaining what it does not do.
First and foremost, this bill does not contain a so-called kill switch that would allow the president to seize control or all or part of the internet.
Many people believe an earlier version did contain a kill switch. That raised fears the U.S. could shut down most internet activity the way Egypt did during last year's revolution. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California ran interference when it came to another privacy concern.
This legislation provides no new authority for government surveillance.
That contention may be a tougher sell. Privacy groups are already afraid that cybersecurity legislation would allow law enforcement to inspect messages that you send out over the internet. Sharon Bradford Franklin is with a group called the Constitution Project. She offers this example. A company stops an email, sends it to the Department of Homeland Security, and says it's a cyber attack. The bill, she says, could allow law enforcement to look through the contents of that message.
The provisions for disclosure to law enforcement have a very low standard.
Meaning there's nothing to stop law enforcement from using that information for more than just cybersecurity. Those who wrote the bill say these fears are just not grounded in the legislation. But when it comes to things cyber, the world changed in January. That's when the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, sparked worldwide outrage. Congress was flooded with protests. Wikipedia went dark for a day, and Congress had to table that law. James Lewis with the Center for Strategic and International Studies says privacy groups are unfairly casting this bill in the same light.
And this isn't regulating the internet. This is regulating critical infrastructure. This is regulating gas pipelines and electrical power companies and things like that.
But there's a lot of history working here. The bill would allow the Department of Homeland Security to work with other agencies to guard against cyber threats. That's raised fears the National Security Agency might get involved. They are the intelligence community's lead eavesdropping agency. James Lewis says that reminds people that during the Bush administration, the NSA was involved in a secret domestic surveillance program.
It is a reasonable concern. You had a program that was probably illegal. Folks say, how do I know this won't happen again?
Still, some lawmakers would like to see the National Security Agency more involved in domestic cybersecurity. The agency is already playing a key role in sharing information with defense contractors. Senator John McCain argued in the hearing, by putting Homeland Security in charge, the bill ignores all the expertise at NSA.
And I question why we have yet to have a serious discussion about who is best suited, which agency, who's best suited to protect our country from this threat.
So supporters of the bill face threats from two fronts, from privacy advocates and now from Senator McCain and other Republicans who want to block this proposal and start over. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
I have just walked outside the main NPR headquarters building, and we're in downtown D.C. It is a bright, clear day. I've just laced up my sneakers because I'm about to get chased by zombies. All right, now, this is a new game. We're going to test it out here, and I've got a button here, start mission. All right, here we go.
So you'll see the township as we loop round. Not much more than a few fences to keep the zombies out.
All right, so not sure which is going to be the bigger danger here, getting caught by the zombies or the traffic that's heading my way from Mass Ave. Let's pick it up.
If you're alive, if there's anyone alive...
Oh yeah, I'm
this
alive.
This is Sam Yao from Able Township. You've come down in a nest of hostiles.
Hostiles?
They've heard the noise. They're coming. There are 30... Oh, no, 40.
Oh dear, that does not sound good.
Your only safe path is towards the tower.
The tower.
You should be able to see that from where you are.
I see a safe way.
Alive there, just
I see Chipotle.
Run!
Run! Run! I'm running!
So happily, I did manage to outrun the zombies that time and live to tell the tale. It is all part of a new running game called Zombies Run, and it's designed to encourage folks to exercise. The game is the brainchild of British writer Naomi Alderman, and she says the idea came to her when she signed up for a class for amateur runners.
The start of the course, they said to us, why do you want to learn how to run? And one woman said, I want to be able to outrun the zombie horde. Then I thought, this would be a good idea for a game.
Well, I got a little bit of a taste of it this morning. I was doing laps around the NPR building. And I was very focused on not getting caught by the zombies. But I gather I was also supposed to be on some sort of mission collecting things. Explain to us how this game works.
So the idea is you are runner five. You come from a small base, the last shivering remnant of humanity. You have to go out running, or you can do it by walking. We want to be open to people of all fitness levels. You have to go out to collect supplies for your base. So as you're going, it goes, bing, you got some toilet paper. Bing, you got some bottled water. And when you get back home on your phone, you'll see, okay, you picked up 7 batteries, allot them to a different place in the base. So that gives every run that feeling of, I'm doing something important, I'm growing my base. There's also an ongoing story where at some point somebody will say to you, runner five, there's a child stuck in no man's land. Run to get them before the zombies come. Rawr.
So these are all these voices that I was hearing as I was running, giving me specific instructions and speed up and slow down. And I have to admit, I mean, you know, it gets you moving. I think I managed to complete level 1. But if you stick with it, you're going to go through various levels and keep getting different assignments. But they're all going to involve trying to get away from the zombies. Is that right?
They are.
Now, one thing I was worried about was, okay, I'm running my fastest, but I don't know if these zombies are sub 6-minute milers or what.
There are different speeds of zombies. Basically, we have something that is called hardcore mode, where if you switch it on, then yeah, the zombies are going to chase you, but you can also turn off hardcore mode, and then there's
just a
zombie
story. Yeah, I was definitely not in hardcore mode. I was in still need my coffee mode.
Excellent.
I was a bit worried before I went out and actually did it, how you do a game just through a narrative, not, you know, no images that you're looking at here.
Yeah, that was very important to us, because there are other sort of running games that might, like, put some kind of monster in your path, but you have to be looking at the screen in order to see it. And we were just like, this is not safe. So that was where we started. We started with the idea that we wanted to do something where it was all audio. And I would say also, if you have the hardcore mode on where zombies are going to catch you, we very strongly advise you not to do it in traffic.
Not to do it. That was my fatal error. Near fatal error,
oh, no.
I should say, as I was out testing it. Now, I did manage not to get caught by the zombies. Tell me exactly what happens if they catch you.
Well, the first time they catch you, it's just going to say the zombie has caught you. But after a number of times they catch you, then you have failed this mission. You have to start the mission again,
which
means more running. So, you know, good for your heart.
Which is the whole point here anyway, so there you go.
Well, exactly.
That's writer Naomi Alderman. She writes a weekly column on games and technology for The Guardian newspaper, and she created the new game Zombies Run. The app is out for the iPhone February 27th. Naomi, thanks for a great workout.
Great talking to you.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, the government approved the first new nuclear reactor power plants in over 30 years. But in the meantime, the Department of Defense has been investigating a different energy source for its military bases, solar. My next guest says the military could install 7 gigawatts of solar power on its bases. That's roughly equivalent to the output of 7 nuclear power plants. And that's all without interfering with bombing ranges or rocket tests and, of course, the Desert Tortoise. Would this be a smart move for the military? Would it increase energy security? And could some of that extra wattage, perhaps, find its way into your home? Robert Corton is Vice President and Director of Renewable Energy Practice at ICF International in Fairfax, Virginia. He joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So the Pentagon commissioned you to study the solar energy.
They did.
And for what reason?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons. There are many different competing pressures for land out in the Mojave and Colorado deserts. You've got conservation interests, off-road vehicle interests, large renewable energy development pressure on the public land in the desert. And I think what they were looking for is whether any of that renewable energy development could be accommodated on the military bases and thereby free up some of the land outside the fence lines for other needs.
Mm-hmm. And I'm actually surprised, I'm sure maybe you were also, by the amount of potential solar energy you could use out there, 7 gigawatts?
It was surprising to some and perhaps disappointing to others. So a lot of people felt that given the very heavy mission use of these military installations and also given the presence of endangered species such as the desert tortoise that you already referred to, that it would be unlikely you'd be able to site very much at all, at least not on the ground, you know, certainly rooftops, but rooftops are a fairly small area. So the surprise, at least for me, was that there was some ground that could accommodate solar. And when you talk in the context of a six million acre inventory of land, even if only a small percentage of that is available for solar development, it adds up quickly.
Mm-hmm. And so it would not, if you were to install, let's say, solar panels there, you would not be interfering with the military operations, the gunnery things, the whatever tests that go on there?
Well, those were the principal reasons that land could not be used. So, again, we started with about 6 million acres of land across these 9 installations, and essentially we did an elimination analysis. We looked at what the competing uses of the land were, and the mission activities, of course, were number one, and they alone accounted for the vast majority of the land that was unavailable for solar installation. So on the order of 97-98% of all the land on those installations is unavailable for solar development, but the remaining 1-2% still can host a substantial amount.
Now, is it possible that they could export some of this? Let's say they could become an energy exporter, sell it to the community where they live.
Yeah, certainly that is possible. They have legal authority that allows them to do that. And they have been exploring, in fact, a couple of large projects that may, in fact, fit that very model. But it's a little more complicated than that in that, if you're a military installation, you're very busy. You've got a lot of other things going on. Your public works staff, your real estate staff, your natural resource staff all have their hands full with a lot of different things. So one of the questions that we posed in our study was how will DOD evolve to accommodate these potentially large solar installations that would be selling into the public grid when essentially those projects might not be supplying much in the way of energy to the installation itself. So there's going to have to be a good reason. There's going to have to be a scale-up of capability at DOD to do that. It's not quite an automatic outcome of the study.
Would they have asked you to study this if they were not serious about going ahead and doing something with the result of your study?
Well, I'd actually turn that question on its head. DOD had already been doing quite a bit before this study was ever commissioned. They built a large solar installation at Nellis Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas. At about the same time that the study was published, DOD announced the contract for a similarly sized solar installation at the China Lake Naval Weapons Station in California. So DOD had already been doing some good things. They also do a lot of R&D work on advanced energy technology. The issue is whether this study, opened more eyes than just my own, and whether, given that there's now, this large potential visible, whether it might cause senior leadership at the department to scale up their plans or decide on targets that can fit within that potential.
Because I'm imagining there would be loads of red tape that would have to be cut for something like this to move quickly ahead.
Well, you know, it's a government department, so things generally don't move terribly quickly. The good news is that there have been some legal authorities put in place in recent years that have allowed the department to work with private developers, where the private developer essentially invests their own capital into these projects. The government doesn't have to invest any of its own money. And that allows projects to go ahead without waiting for appropriations. There's still a lot of contracting involved. There's still a lot of land use analysis. And these new authorities are only really being tested out now, apparently successfully. And hopefully as the first ones, you know, are successfully completed, it'll be a lot easier to replicate them in the future.
Does the military argue that this is a security benefit for the military to build these things?
It can be, but it's a bit more complicated than it might at first appear. So a solar installation on a military base, there it is generating electricity. And in theory, you would say, well, gee, if the public grid goes down, couldn't that solar plant provide power to that base and keep that base lit up and doing what it needs to do? The reality is, under the way that the electric grid is governed, if the grid goes down due to, a tornado, an earthquake, what have you, that solar plant has to shut down immediately. The lines need to be de-energized so that utility workers can do the repair work and not be at risk of being shocked by electricity being fed in. So in order to create a real energy security asset, a lot of other technology and systems and process needs to be put into place. Energy storage, islanding capability, microgrids, things like that, all of which DOD is researching right now on some of these same installations.
And, of course, you'd have to get to the main grid if you're going to be sending it someplace.
Yes, and that also can be a non-trivial challenge. The transmission grid in California is very congested. There's not a lot of capacity available to accept large injections of electrons from anybody, whether it's a fossil-fired plant or a solar plant, and that is a major constraint to further development.
But one thing standing or in the Pentagon's favor, as you pointed out and as we've talked about here on this show, is that the military seems to be in the forefront of renewable energy.
Yes.
The Navy has been looking into alternative fuels besides diesel because it's the biggest diesel user in the world. We've had other people talking about alternative energy things. They really are thinking heavily about this.
Yeah, and in a number of different ways. So you go all the way to the kind of the forward edge where our soldiers, Marines, airmen are in combat, and they're dependent on a very long supply chain of petroleum coming in through ports in Pakistan, and that's a very vulnerable supply chain. So, out on the battlefield, the forward operating bases, the military is looking for ways of using renewably generated electricity and locally generated fuels so they don't have to have as many of their soldiers at risk protecting convoys of fuel. Mm-hmm. And then further back, whether you're talking about ships at sea or aircraft aloft, looking to diversify their fuel supplies. And then back here in the United States, what can we do to cost-effectively implement alternative energy sources on our military installations?
If this idea were to go forward and they would start building these solar plants on the military bases, you say that they would probably hire subcontractors to come in, so you're creating local jobs in the community also.
Yes, there'd be construction jobs to build these facilities, and then a much smaller number of operations and maintenance jobs. It's not a huge employment in the long run, just because you don't need a lot of people to keep a solar plant operating.
If there is an independent company that wants to build these solar plants, why would they want to go into a base? Why not just go and build one themselves? What's to their advantage to work with the government on this?
Well, it's a good question. A solar development company does have options. They can build and have built large solar plants on Bureau of Land Management land, public land outside of these military bases. They can build on private land, and they've done so. I think that the military bases offer some incremental benefits and also some incremental costs compared to those alternatives. The benefits are these military bases are very large loads. They consume a lot of electricity, and therefore your solar installation, instead of selling out into the wholesale power market over the fence, which tends to be competitively priced and relatively inexpensive, you can use your electricity to displace the electrons that the local utility company would otherwise deliver. That tends to be more expensive. So you're creating more value. Secondly, you can do more interesting things. You can, again, build things like microgrids and storage and a lot of other innovative types of technologies, which allow you to deliver more value to the military customer, things that you can't do on a piece of open land that might be outside of the fence. So the relationship to that load is very important.
So what should we watch for to see if your message gets through?
Well, you know, it's only been a month since the report came out, so I'm not looking for any sky riders in the sky. I think that it's going to take time. I think that the management of the department needs to consider the implications of the study. Some of them are the numerical ones that we've talked about. We also offered a range of policy and programmatic recommendations. I get the sense that as long as renewable energy can be demonstrated to be cost-effective, enhance the energy security of these installations, not get in the way of the primary missions of these installations, they're very willing to move forward. I think it's just going to be a matter of time as the program scales up.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Robert Quarton is Vice President and Director of Renewable Energy Practices at ICF International in Fairfax, Virginia. And you say there's 7 gigawatts. Could there be more out there? Possible?
My guess is, well, there's reasons why there might be more. There's reasons why there might be less. More because the mission compatibility issue is still not a science. It's really an art. Yeah. So there may be land out there that we found to be mission incompatible that somebody with better tools might find is mission compatible at some later date. Less in that we did all of our analysis based on geographic information systems tools, essentially maps. And the reality is once you get out there and walk around the ground where we say that there's solar potential, you may find things that don't show up on maps that might prevent you from moving ahead.
But at least you've got the conversation going.
Indeed.
Thank you, Robert. Robert Quarton, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, and you know, we know it's past Valentine's Day, but we're talking sweet stuff, sugar. My next guest says it can be as toxic as alcohol, and therefore it should be regulated like alcohol. What do you think? We'll be back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Some good news for the nuclear industry. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued licenses for the construction of 2 nuclear reactors at a plant in eastern Georgia. Until last week, the NRC hadn't approved the construction of any new reactors in the U.S. since 1978. That was a year before the partial reactor meltdown at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. The first of the new reactors is expected to be up and running by 2016. Does this signal the start of a nuclear renaissance in the U.S.? Will the reactors have adequate safety features to withstand disasters like the one that unfolded at Fukushima Daiichi? And what role can we expect nuclear power to play in the country's energy future if these reactors come online? We're going to talk to Per Anderson. Per Peterson is professor and chair of the Department of Nuclear Engineering, University of California at Berkeley. His research in the 1990s contributed to the development of passive safety systems, which the new reactors have. Dr. Peterson joins us from Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
What about the timing of this? You know, it seems why are these being given licenses right now?
Well, it's actually been in development for quite some time, and Southern Company has been making tremendous progress on early site preparation, but to move forward to begin pouring concrete for the foundations of these reactors, they did need to have the construction license in place, and now it is, so the construction will start to ramp up quickly from here.
Is this significant?
Well, it is quite significant. As you noted, these are the first new reactors to start construction in the United States in 3 decades. And the experience that will come from building these new reactors will be very important in informing decisions going forward about the role that nuclear energy should play because, of course, the cost of constructing reactors is the most important economic consideration. Once built, the fuel and operations costs are very, very affordable.
And what is the bill on this one?
Well, these, I think, are close to $10 billion. And given the fact that they will produce very, very large amounts of electricity, the electricity they produce ends up being affordable. But, of course, the construction cost is quite large. The fuel operations and maintenance will be on the order of about 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's really the construction costs that are the important issue.
We talked about track record a little bit. Isn't
Isn't the idea that these will be up and running by 2016 a bit optimistic given the track record of building nuclear reactors?
Well, certainly the track record in the past has been rather poor, and that's why people will be looking at these two new plants very closely. Now, they're sister plants, essentially carbon copies, to a set of about six reactors of the same type that are under construction in China, and those reactors are on schedule, on budget. The construction methods for these new reactors that Westinghouse is building is completely different from the old ones. They're actually factory prefabricated and assembled at the site rather than being essentially built in place at the site.
And I guess it is good to have the Chinese have a bit of a head start on these so you can send a team over to watch what's going on.
Yes, indeed. In fact, Southern has had a large number of people over in China observing the construction, as have Westinghouse and Shaw.
And the fact that these are of similar design, because one of the criticisms of the American nuclear industry is that you have so many different designs by different companies that you can't really standardize anything.
That's correct. The existing plants that we have, each one was unique, and it was recognized afterwards, given the poor experience in constructing them, that standardization would be important. Not only that, but when they started the construction on those plants, typically the detailed design would only be about 40% complete, and to issue a combined license, the NRC requires essentially 100% completion of design. So you know exactly what it is you're going to build in advance of starting construction. And people believe that should be very helpful in the construction of these new plants.
There was one dissenting vote for these licenses at the NRC, but it was the chairman,
That is correct. And I think that the key issue here is that we know that these new plant designs, because they incorporate passive safety features and they do not require any electrical power to remove heat after they shut down, would not be subject to the direct set of problems that the plants in Fukushima had. But people also recognize that it's important to review and scrub these designs to make sure that there's no additional lessons from Fukushima that might make changes. And I think that the area of disagreement here related to the timing for getting that done in terms of issuing a construction license versus when those issues need to be looked at closely. But it will happen for these plants, and of course anything that can be learned from Fukushima will be integrated into the design operation of these new plants.
If there's a design change, will they put an amended design to it?
Indeed, I can expect that they would, although what we've learned from Fukushima is that the most important thing to have is the capability to bring in and hook up portable equipment to restore key safety functions like water injection. And so most of the things that we're doing in response to Fukushima do not involve major plant modifications, but rather installing or bringing in additional equipment of portable nature and also upgrading instrumentation, neither of which are major plant modifications.
Are these any of what they're talking about, the Generation 4 nuclear reactors?
No, these are still water-cooled reactors, and I think utilities are most comfortable with this type of reactor technology for this interim period because they have an enormous amount of experience with how well the fuels work and the reliability of the systems. So it's my expectation that we'll see Generation 4 designs with further improvements. Moving into commercial deployment, probably 15, 20 years will be necessary to get to that point.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not going to be every 15, 20 years, we'll see it in another 15, 20 years. Because
well,
these things keep getting pushed into the future, you know? It's like fusion. It's always 30 years away, no matter what year it is. But
One of the interesting things here is this is actual concrete and steel that's being put in place. So these are new plants. But as I'd mentioned before, the experience gained from building these plants will be quite important. In the near term, people are also very interested in developing smaller reactors called SMRs that would use the same fuel and coolant because we think that the financing and deployment of smaller reactors will be easier and that will make it easier to get further development to occur. But we need to remember that all technologies improve over time. And so if you take a look at automobiles, for example, you could go back to the Model T and the Model A. And I would say that the plants that are running today in the United States might be considered to be Model Ts. If these Westinghouse plants are the Model A's, then it'll be quite interesting to see where we are in 40 to 50 years in terms of further major advances in the technology.
One of the problems with the Japanese disaster was that there were those pools for the spent rods and losing water out of them, besides the fact of having the reactor not able to cool itself down. What's the situation with these new reactors and where the fuel rods are kept?
That's correct. And so another major issue at Fukushima was the lack of instrumentation to measure the amount of water in those pools. Fukushima also had a storage pool that looks much closer to the design of the storage pools in the Westinghouse type of reactors. It was a centralized pool in a separate building, and it, along with dry cask storage at the site, performed just fine. So the types of spent fuel pools that the pressurized water reactors like the AP1000 have are much more robust and easy to get access to if you do have accidents or natural disasters. And so I think we can expect that the safety of the fuel storage in AP1000s will be similar to that of the centralized pools at Fukushima, which performed just fine. It was the in-reactor pools up in high elevation in those boiling water reactors that proved to be problematic.
Give us a quick little lesson in how the passive system works that you helped design. And what is it? How does it kick in and work?
Well, the key thing with the passive systems is that once you shut down a reactor, and the types of reactors that we build in the Western countries will shut down automatically. They have negative temperature feedback. So once the fission reaction is shut down, one still continues to produce heat. It's a relatively small fraction of the total power. But if you don't remove this heat reliably, then the fuel can overheat, become damaged, and drive off radioactive material. And in the existing plants, one uses pumps and heat exchangers to circulate water into the reactor to remove this heat. In these new plant designs like the AP1000, the heat is removed purely by buoyancy-driven processes, that is, gravity-driven flows, taking advantage of the fact that hot fluid wants to move up and cold fluid wants to move down. And so in the AP1000, there's actually multiple different passive mechanisms by which you can get heat out of the core. One is over into a large pool of water that sits inside containment, and then you can also depressurize the reactor, and then evaporation of water will cool the core. It'll condense on the walls. They'll run back down again, and the heat ultimately gets sent out to the atmosphere.
Yeah, it runs without power, in other words.
That's correct. No electrical power needed.
And what about safety from, let's say, errant airplane attacks or crashes into the building or even into the area where the rods are stored?
Yes, that's also something that we have considered or is considered in the design of these reactors. And the containment building and structures around the reactors has been designed to sustain that type of airplane crash without allowing parts of the airplane to get inside the reactor building while preserving the integrity of all of the equipment that's inside the building. Mm-hmm. And so these types of external events are considered in the design, and the designs are capable of sustaining them.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the nuclear waste that comes out, what happens to it?
Well, we're in the process, actually, of hopefully getting a new set of policies for nuclear waste. One of the things that I've been able to do over the last 2 years is to serve on a Blue Ribbon Commission that was formed by the Obama administration that has looked at the policy framework that we have for managing spent fuel and high-level waste. And there's really serious problems with that policy framework that have contributed to the long lack of progress in developing solutions for management and disposal of spent fuel and high-level waste. And probably the most important thing that we can do to get to workable solutions will be to act on the recommendations that the Blue Ribbon Commission has made.
We'll get back to you on that, Dr. Peterson. Thank you for joining with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Per Peterson of UC Berkeley. We're going to take a break, come back and talk lots more. Stay with us after this break.